We're in our expository preaching series on the book of Daniel that began in the summer. And here we are in the early fall, and we're just sort of seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. We're on the 11th chapter of the prophet Daniel, which is the second to the last chapter. And it also happens to be the second longest chapter, and maybe the most obscure of all the chapters in the book of Daniel. So before we get into it, I'm going to read some announcements, and so bear with me here. First of all, A.J. Culp will have an ACT class that begins this Tuesday, just two more days from now, entitled Spirit on the Water and Fire on the Mountain, Exploring Key Episodes in Genesis through Deuteronomy. A.J., I saw you walking in. I love that title. Spirit on the Water, Fire on the Mountain. I know both passages that this brings to mind. And it's every Tuesday evening, beginning next Tuesday through November 13th, 8 weeks, from 7 to 8:15, in the classroom that's right down that hallway, what today, right now, is the first grade class. So that's the first announcement. Second one, a week from yesterday, in other words, this next Saturday, will be a fall men's breakfast. That'll be September 29th at 8 a.m. with pancakes and all sorts of other good stuff. And yours truly will be the speaker on why men sometimes self-destruct in the area of sexuality. And then number three, there will be a group led by Paul Skrabek and Eric Anderson that will start on Monday evenings, off-site and somewhere around a campfire, starting October 1st. And it'll also run for 6 weeks. It's for guys only. Contact Paul Skrabek to RSVP. The group's going to be called No Compromise, Being Pure in an Impure World. And then finally, and this is a sad moment, we're going to say goodbye to the Starks who are over here today. They've finished up the work that they did here for the summer, and they're going to go back to Mexico. And so say your goodbyes with them to them today, because this will be their last Sunday. And continue to pray and hold them up, not only for safe travels down there, but their transition back into ministry and for success in that work that they have started in Malinaco, that it just goes from a Bible study to a full-fledged church. And so that's what we're praying towards, and just say your goodbyes to them today. We normally would have them up here for a prayer during the next service, but the next service is already shortened, and you can see there's a baptismal tank right behind me. So I dare not take too many steps back today, right? All right, that's it for our announcements. And because chapter 11 is so long, I traditionally at this moment we have a public reading of the passage, but I'm going to just dispense with that just for today, and we will read large portions of this passage as I go through and try to explain this chapter. Like I said, Daniel 11 is the second longest chapter in Daniel, and it clearly builds on other chapters found within Daniel. And so in some respects, there are great portions of it in which there's really nothing new. If you followed in detail the sermons on Daniel 2 and 7 and 8, there's much that is repeated from those chapters in this chapter. You know, many of Daniel's visions revolve around the idea variously expressed that there will arise in human history four world kingdoms or world dominions, and they will arise in succession one after another. They'll be cruel, but they'll be replaced by a fifth kingdom whose origin is heavenly, but its expression is on earth, and that kingdom will never end, and that kingdom will never pass to an heir. That is the kingdom of Christ. Now, Daniel 11 begins by recording the transition from the second to the third of those first four world dominions, that is, from Persia to Greece. So let's turn to the book of Daniel, chapter 11, verses 2 through 5, or you can read it on the screen behind me if that's working today. And let's just read the first few verses, beginning at chapter 2 of Daniel 11. Daniel writes this, "And now I," that's the Lord, "and I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise. Now, this is a Greek king they're talking about, namely Alexander the Great, who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up, and it'll go to others besides these. Now, honestly, there's not much new information here, especially if you really paid attention when David covered Daniel chapter 8. Four kings will yet arise in Persia. This has already happened. The fourth, it says, will be more rich and more powerful. And this appears to be a man by the name of Xerxes I. Now, that would have been his throne name. And in those days, kings often had a throne name and, of course, a given name, a personal name. And though we don't know for sure, we think Xerxes I is the same man as Ahasuerus, who is the husband of Queen Esther from the book of Esther. We're not positive of that, but there is some historical evidence for that, that this is the man that took Esther as his queen. And during his reign, it is true, history records outside of the Bible, that he assembled an incredible force of Persians, and he pushed west. But when he got to the area of Thrace and Macedonia and Greece, he was repelled and decidedly defeated in three battles by the Greeks. And he went home with his tail between his legs. And really, from that moment on, Persian power was broken. But the Greeks never counterattacked at that point, but they never forgot their hatred of the Persians. And 50 years later, it's Alexander the Great that unites the Macedonians and the Greeks, really building on the foundation of his father Philip. And he exploits that anger and resentment. And he pushes first into Egypt. And in a lightning speed, he conquers Egypt. And he's proclaimed the son of Ammon. And then he pushes to the east and he conquers the Persians in a series of great battles. He was ablaze. He really was ablaze. He pushed so far that he was right at the threshold of India, and he wanted to push in, but his troops said, "That's enough, Alexander," and they began to mutiny against him. And so wisely, he turned around. He returned to the city of Babylon, which he had conquered previously, and within 6 months, he was dead. Now, some say he died of a mosquito bite that transmitted some sort of tropical disease that he had no immunities to, like malaria or dengue fever. Some say that he was assassinated there. It is true that Alexander, in a sense, was going mad before he died. He actually believed that he was God manifest on the earth. And he actually asked his soldiers to begin to worship him. And his soldiers found that extremely distasteful. And it is possible that one of them assassinated him. But his kingdom, when he dies, does not pass to his heirs. Actually, when he died, he had no living heir, but his wife, Roxana, was pregnant with his son, Hercules. But shortly after Roxana gave birth, one of Alexander's generals, a man by the name of Cassander, one of the four, kills Roxana and Hercules. So within just a few months, you have no Alexander, no Roxana, and no Hercules. And the great Greek empire is divided towards, our passage says, the four winds, that is to say, to his four most powerful generals. Now, two of those generals the Bible ignores in chapter 11. It could care less about two of them. And the rest of the, at least from verses 5 through 20, the Bible is preoccupied with two of those generals, but they are covered under code words. Sometimes they're called in the Bible cryptograms. The king of the north and the king of the south. Nobody is actually ever named. Now, who is the king of the south? Well, it begins with a general, one of Alexander's four, by the name of Ptolemy. And the king of the south isn't one man. It's a series of kings and queens. And they have power, and that covers 150 years. But they're never named by name. They're just called the king of the north, or the successor, or the then the successor. It's pretty obvious when you can tell there's a succession of power in verses 5 through 20. And who's the king of the north? Well, the original of the four generals that is the king of the north is a man by the name of Antigonus. But he lasts so shortly that there's another king that follows him named Seleucus. And Seleucus heads a dynasty that is called the Seleucid Kingdom. So the king of the south is Egypt, or the Ptolemaic Kingdom, and the king of the north is the Seleucid Kingdom. Sometimes it's also called Syria. But Syria doesn't even exist at this point, so it's really, that's reading back a more modern name into ancient history. The king of the south, the king of the north. Now, the main reason the Bible will spend a great deal of attention on these otherwise obscure kingdoms, as they war or make treaties, they go back and forth, power changes, there's treaties, there's intrigue, there's all these kinds of things. It's because the little province of Judah is caught in the crossfire between these two kings of the north and the south. And by the way, Judah is also never mentioned by name in chapter 11, but it is also referred to by code names or cryptograms like the province or the covenant or the holy covenant or even one time the temple and the fortress. But you'll never read the name Jew or Jews in the passage. So now let's go back to chapter 11 and let's read a bit about the struggles between the kings of the north and the kings of the south, which basically preoccupies verses 5 through 20 of our passage. Let's look at verse 5. And then the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes, so you now you see there's already a succession that's happened here, shall be stronger than he and shall rule, and his authority shall be a great authority. And after some years, they shall make an alliance, that is, between the north and the south, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and he and his arm shall not endure, but she shall be given up, and her attendants, and he who fathered her, and he who supported her in those times. Now, I've just read two verses, but really, verses 5 through 20 pretty much read just like this. The king of the south does this, the king of the north reacts, or there's reaction and counter-reaction and counter-counter-reaction and back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And it covers 150 years of what otherwise would be very obscure Greek history. In fact, it goes well into a period of time that we would call the intertestamental period, that period between the close of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament, which is also often called the silent years. But in this chapter, they're not very silent at all. Now, let me summarize verses 5 through 20 I'm not going to read. I am going to be the editor of this chapter because it's so long. I have read you two verses. But the character of the following verses doesn't vary very much. You and I may not know our Greek history. This is actually very obscure material. I don't know personally, I don't have a knowledge of ancient history to be able to personally verify the accuracy of this. Some of you might, but I would reason to guess that my friend Mike Douglas here, he doesn't know Greek history well enough either. But I want you to know that for 2,000 years, there have always been experts on Greek history. And one of the things that is unique about this portion of the Bible is that it has been criticized not because it's inaccurate, but actually because it's too accurate. It has so many almost mundane details covering 150 years of Greek history that many people look at it that actually know Greek history and go, that's impossible that any prophet would know those obscure details. It's too specific. Now, I myself wonder, what is the point of verses 5 through 20? It almost gives tedious detail without even mentioning how history affects God, God's covenant, God's plan, God's people. You know, historians know from other sources at this time that during this 150 years of history between the king in the north and the king of the south, which would be 323 BC through 175 BC, that the Jews in Judah are always heavily taxed by whoever is in authority at that time. However, they're pretty much left alone, except for having to pay heavy taxes. We know actually some things about this period of time. We know that the house of David is slipping more and more and more into obscurity. That's why when you open up your New Testament and you see that Joseph, the son of David, is a carpenter in Nazareth, it's because of what has happened for the previous 400 years. The house of David is in shambles. And the men that should have been the kings were literally reduced to just common tradesmen, carpenters, candle makers, bakers, things like that. And the high priest during this period of time, this 150 years, is never called a king, but he is the one who rises up. And he doesn't just have religious authority over the temple and the sacrifices and things like that, but he becomes a quasi-political leader also. He becomes really the authority. When other world governments want to address Judah, they actually speak to the high priest. He takes on a kind of political role. And then on a local level, it's probably the elders of Israel that operate and administer local affairs. We also know during this time period, and this is really key to understanding this passage, that there are many forces trying to reshape Israel's existence. The process, the key word during this period of time, is called Hellenization. Now, if you've never heard that term before, Hellenization is the process of making the world like the Greek world. To take these eastern cities, of which Jerusalem is one, Babylon is one, Susa is one, and making them basically Greek cities. Literally, Hellenizing means that Greek is becoming the lingua franca. It's becoming the language of the whole earth during that time. And most of the cities are embracing this. And the Egyptians, they're not building pyramids, and the Babylonians aren't building ziggurats anymore. Greek architecture is winning the day. That's what cities are starting to look like Athens. But it's in Babylon, and it's in Susa. And Greek coinage, and Greek mathematics, and philosophy, and religion, and marketing strategy, and of course the language, it's reshaping the world. It's winning over the Eastern world. And Judah feels the pressure to become more Greek, and many wealthy families that are nominally religious within Judah at this time actually begin to go with the flow and adopt Greek values. Even to the point where they won't even circumcise their little boys anymore. They don't want to be Jews. And it's during this time that there arises a counter-reaction, and again we know this not from this chapter but from other historical records, there's a counter-reaction. A Puritan movement arises, and we don't know whether the name comes from other people or they named themselves this, but they called themselves at this time the Hasidim, which means either the ones whom God made holy or it means the holy ones, whether it's active or passive. But this starts out as a Puritan movement. They are a movement that will eventually distort and become a parody of what they started out to be. You want to know who the Pharisees are in the New Testament? They start during this period. They start as the Hasidim, the Holy Ones. In these early stages, the Hasidim, however, are in no way a Pharisee. They're not that at that point yet. They're in the early part of their history. Now this takes us to the next section, which is verses 21 through 35. And I've entitled that on my outline on the back page, The Climactic King of the North. Now you're going to know why he's covered 150 years of Greek history, because it's all laying the stage for the rise of one particular king of the North, one Antiochus IV, who rules from 175 to 163 BC, which is only 12 years. So why would a king who only ruled 12 years command 50% of the passage in the 11th chapter of Daniel? Well, simply put, there are two reasons. Number one, this king will target Judah and the Jews for the first purely religious persecution ever recorded in ancient history. Antiochus will do his level best, beginning in about the middle of his regency, to wipe the worship of Yahweh off the face of the earth. And the persecution and the death and the torture that he uses against the Jews is so blood-curdling and twisted that it leads to a great Jewish rebellion against the Greeks. The revolt starts out like a guerrilla operation, but within very little time, these Jewish guerrilla warriors actually build armies that have full-scale engagement with the Greeks, and they win most of the key operations. The revolt today is called the Maccabean Revolt. It lasts way past the death of Antiochus and is eventually successful in freeing Judah from all the Greek rule. And Judah will become an independent kingdom eventually. Within 30 years, Judah will become an independent kingdom. It'll stand on its own two feet. It'll have foreign relationships with the Greeks and Rome and treaties and things like that roughly for 70 years. Now those group of people that started out as guerrilla fighters and win the war, their heirs become the aristocracy, and they actually arrogate to themselves, though they are of the tribe of Levi, the title king and the title queen. And the Hasidim at that point separate from these freedom fighters, because again, they are a Puritan movement. And the word separate is related to the word Pharisee. That's where the word Pharisee comes from. Why would the Pharisees separate? Because the house of Levi shouldn't ever have the throne. The house of David should have the throne. And if you want to know where the Sadducees come from in your New Testament, this aristocracy, when they lose power, they still become the ruling power, the power that has power even under the Romans. And the high priesthood, that are all Sadducees, and they are really the heirs of these guerrilla fighters in your New Testament. The second reason Antiochus IV gets 50% of the chapter devoted to him is because, and you know this from Daniel chapter 8, he is a type of the end times Antichrist. He is the son of destruction, the lawless one, as Paul refers to him in 1 and 2 Thessalonians. He is the beast, as John refers to him in the Revelation. He's a type of the beast. I'm making that clear. He is the abomination of desolation that Jesus refers to in the Olivet Discourse. And just as Jesus had types that preceded him, all right, you know there are men in the Old Testament that in some ways prefigure Christ, like Adam and Joseph and David and Solomon. So the end times Antichrist is preceded by this man who only rules 12 years. And so in studying Antiochus, there's a sense in which we are studying both the man of the past and the man of the future. So let's read Daniel 11, 21 and 22 that deals with how he comes, after 150 years of Greek history, how he comes on the scene. Verse 21, and this is all about Antiochus the Fourth. In his place shall arise, in whose place? Well, in his brother. His brother was actually the king before him. In his place shall arise a contemptible person. Now that's the only way he's described in this passage. To whom royal majesty has not been given, he shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. And armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. Now this is the first time Judah is mentioned too, under that code word covenant. Here's the background to 21 and 22. Antiochus was released from prison in Rome. He was held in Rome as a surety so that his father would pay the tribute that he owed the Romans, which was, in today's dollars, $90 million a year. So Antiochus IV basically would have had his head lopped off if his father didn't cough up the right amount of tribute. And they kept him until his father dies and his brother becomes the king. And then they go, hey, we need a better surety than that. The new king may let his brother die. So they went, the Romans, and they got the son of the new king, and they let Antiochus go. Now, as Antiochus was making his way back to the city he was born in, on his way back home, his brother also dies. And so he poses at first as someone who wants to make sure that his little nephew gets on the throne one day. Oh, I just only care about my little nephew. I want my nephew to be. But then actually he takes the throne for himself. And the references to armies being swept away probably refers just in general to a military campaign that he initiates against Egypt, which is the king of the south. Now, the reference to sweeping away the prince of the covenant is the first time Judah is actually mentioned. And this refers to the fact that Antiochus, in order to get more tribute from Judah, he has a man that whispers something in his ear, and his name is Jason. And he says, I will give you, if you make me the high priest, I will give you more tribute than the rightful high priest, a man named Onias. And Antiochus listens to him. And he says, okay, you're going to get me more tribute? Then you can be the high priest now. And he put the real high priest in prison. Now, right after that, another man named Menelaus, which is the name of an ancient Greek god, he promises even more tribute. So Jason is swept out of office too. And Menelaus isn't even maybe a Jew. For sure, he's not of the tribe of Levi. He can't even be, by Jewish law, he can't even be a high priest. And now the Hasidim really has something to try to purify within Judah. And this giving of the priesthood of God to the highest bidder is what verse 23 is really getting at. Verse 23 reads like this: "And from the time of that alliance, from the time that an alliance is made with him, that's either Jason or Menelaus, he shall act deceitfully, and yes, he will, and he shall become strong with a small people." Now, that small people refers to the powerful, but a small part of Israel that wanted to Hellenize and throw in their lot with Antiochus IV. Verse 24 describes more deceptions either by Antiochus or Menelaus. And we know that it's true that Menelaus actually, through deceit, will rob the temple of Jerusalem. Verse 24, "Without warning, he shall come into the richest part of the province," which would have been the temple, and the province is Judah, "and he shall do what neither his fathers nor his fathers' fathers have done, scattering among them plunder, spoil, and goods. He shall devise plans against strongholds, but only for a time." Now, this again probably refers to Menelaus, who had to resort, because he made these promises, I will get you more money, I will get you more taxation. And Menelaus basically poses as a guy that has the best interests of Jerusalem in mind. And then once the Jews let their guard down and they reopen up the temple, then he just robs the temple. And you know, in those days, temples weren't just temples, they were also banks. In the ancient world, temples and banks were synonymous. So there was a lot of money in there. If you had your money in the First National of Jerusalem on that day, you would have been impoverished. So Antiochus then uses the temple's assets to buy influence in Judah. He spreads the money around. That little party within Judah that are his friends, he enriches them in order to gain even more loyalties. Then in verse 25 and 27, it speaks of Antiochus resuming his first military campaign against Egypt, which ends in a treaty, in which really Antiochus wins, but neither party really keeps the provisions of the treaty. It reads like this, verse 25, "And he shall stir up his power and his heart against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army, but he will not stand. For plots shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his food shall break with him. His army will be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. And as for the two kings, their hearts shall be bent on doing evil. And they shall speak lies at the same table," that's a reference to treaties, "but to no avail, for the end is yet to be at the appointed time." And then Antiochus returns from Egypt to his capital, but verse 28 hints that his hatred of Judah is growing. It says, "And he shall return to his land with a great wealth," that is the spoils of Egypt, "but his heart shall be set against the Holy Covenant, and he shall work his will and return to his own land." Now, I want you to note that it's more than just an individual here that is starting to crystallize. It's not just an individual that hates God and God's things. Now, remember this very well. It's not an individual. It's an individual embodied with the powers of government, which takes evil and multiplies it 100-fold. And that's exactly what's going to happen to Judah. Then verse 29 and 30 describes a second campaign against Egypt. And you know I'm going through this very quickly because the key things are yet to come here. Verse 29 and 30, second campaign against Egypt that at first is successful, then is cut short by the Romans. Now, nobody is called Romans in this passage. But then again, nobody is called Seleucid, nobody's called Ptolemaic, nobody's called Judah. There are always code words, cryptograms, that is used. And the cryptogram for the Romans is the ships of Kittim. And Kittim is the old name for Cyprus, and Cyprus was the then farthest extent of Roman power to the east, the ships of Kittim. So look at verse 29, and you're going to see that Antiochus has a brush with the power of Rome, which will be the fourth empire. It actually hints at the succession from the third empire to the fourth empire in this one passage. Verse 29, "And at the appointed time he shall return and come to the south," in other words, to resume this campaign, "but it shall not be this time as it was before. For the ships of Kittim shall come against him, and he shall be afraid and withdraw." Now, what's the story behind that? You see, on one of those ships was a Roman general named Popilius Lenus. And he got off one of those ships, and he went to Antiochus, and he said, "Leave Egypt now. From now on, it belongs to Rome." And Antiochus the IV said, "Let me think about it." And the Roman took out his sword, and he walked around Antiochus the IV, and he drew a circle on the sands of Egypt around Antiochus, and he says, "Sir, I will have your answer before you leave this circle." And Antiochus folds. He does not want to have a battle with the Romans. He knows he will lose. And so he withdraws. And when he leaves Egypt, he is in such a foul, enraged mood that when one of his couriers gives him a message and says, "Hey, you know what's going on in Jerusalem? They think you died in this battle. And that guy Jason, who used to be your high priest, he's attacking Jerusalem right now, trying to unseat the guy that you appointed, Menelaus, as the high priest." And so Antiochus, who is not dead at all, goes to Jerusalem not only to kill Jason, but now he wants to wipe out the whole Jewish faith. He wants to be done with it. He is sick of it. And so you read, "And he shall turn back and be enraged and take action against the Holy Covenant. He shall turn back and pay attention to those who forsake the Holy Covenant," that's his allies within Judah, "and forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and the fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering, and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate," which is a reference to setting up the image of the Greek god Zeus in the temple of God. They also slaughtered pigs on the altar. They also did other things that are actually just too gross to mention, but are recorded in the books of 1 and 2 Maccabees, which were all done in an effort to so pollute the sacred temple that it could never be used for the worship of Yahweh again. And then we read in verse 32, "And he shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant," again, his allies within Judah, "but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action." Now this refers to the rise of a priest by the name of Mattathias and his sons Judas and Jonathan and Simon, and then Simon's son John Hyrcanus, and they will begin an armed rebellion, which will be called the Maccabean Rebellion, against Antiochus. And our passage concludes in verses 33 and 35, and it says, "And the wise among the people shall make many understand, though for some days they shall stumble by sword and flame and by captivity and plunder." Now the Bible uses great restraint here. Great restraint. By sword and flame and captivity and plunder. What the Greeks do to the Jews is so gross. I know that sounds like a teenage word here. That we actually have a word in English that tries to capture it, and it's the word macabre. You've ever heard from the old radio show Tales of the Macabre? That means, the word macabre comes from Maccabean. And it means when something is so chilling and so twisted and so blood-curdling, because it describes the tortures of the Greeks towards the Jews. And it goes on to say, "And when they stumble," now you'll see here there's an emphasis on moral and religious purification, "and when they stumble, they shall receive a little help. And many shall join themselves to them with flattery," that is to the Greeks, "and some of the wise shall stumble, so that they may be refined and purified and made white until the end of time, for it still awaits the appointed time." Now, this process implies, like I said, a purification of the Jews through extreme persecution. And though it is not mentioned, Antiochus himself is almost immediately called away to a problem in the eastern portion near Babylon, the eastern portion of his kingdom. And there he dies in battle. And literally, it takes Antiochus's next five successors to prosecute this war against the Jews, and they end up losing in the end 28 years later. And Antiochus will never see it, but his persecution, instead of wiping out the knowledge of God and the Jewish people, it actually galvanizes Jewish faith, and it galvanizes Jewish religion until they become an independent nation. Like I said, from 135 to 64 BC, about 70 years, they become an independent nation. Until 63 BC, when the Roman general Pompey exploits a situation where there was a weakness in the monarchy, he marches into Jerusalem and says, from now on, Judah belongs to the Romans. Now, I want you to note this. From 63 BC to 1942 AD, Israel does not exist as an independent nation. But from 1942 onwards, it is again, after a 2,000-year hiatus, it is an independent nation. Now, the prophecy is not done. David Anderson will finish it next week. Really, everything I've covered today is fulfilled prophecy. So what makes this anything more than just a lesson on ancient history? And a really obscure portion of ancient history at that. Let me just give you four. I think I have 10 minutes left. Is that correct?
15.
15, five after. Okay. I'll take every one. Let me give you four fairly practical lessons about why would you ever study fulfilled prophecy? Why wouldn't we just dispense of that, just exit out of our Bibles and just pay attention to the unfulfilled prophecy? Well, number one, this is a chapter about the horror of human evil, especially concentrated in the power of the state. That's really all of Daniel's about this. This is a lesson we cannot be naive about. Individuals can do great evil, like we just saw this summer in a theater in Aurora, but when evil is concentrated in the human state, it is multiplied to horrific levels. It always has been that way. The 20th century was marked by unprecedented levels of human killing and evil embodied in state governments who wanted to set up their version of heaven on earth. And look out. 21st century will have more of the same. In fact, as we secularize and as our country has no heaven to look forward to, there's even going to be a stronger temptation to view the state as the job of the state is to make a heaven on earth. And whenever the state, any state, whether it's the Germans or the Vietnamese or the Chinese or the Russians or even the Americans, whenever the state begins to believe it's their job to set up heaven on earth, they will make hell on earth for somebody. They always have. They always have. And so what's lesson number one? Do not be naive about human government. It is prophecy after prophecy after prophecy that said evil will always be multiplied extraordinarily in government. Now, this is the truth that, in a sense, balances the other truth that we're taught in the New Testament. We all know Paul teaches in Romans 13, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except from God, and those who exist have been instituted by God. You know, as true as that is, it never means the government cannot morph into anti-God and even anti-Christ. It does. It has in the past. It will in the future. So we have to have a balanced view of government. We have to have a realistic view. We have to have a guarded view of government. It can restrain, and it does restrain evil. The only reason I don't drive 90 miles an hour in my sports car is because I'm afraid of the Colorado State Patrol. It restrains me. I love to go fast. I just don't do it very often. But in my heart, I'm a rebel. Government can restrain evil, but government can propagate extraordinary evil. And so we can never be naive. That's lesson number one of studying fulfilled prophecy. Lesson number two, and this is a short point, but it's a key point. All of Daniel's prophecies, this included, make clear two great truths about this world. And you can bank on these two great truths. The judgment of evil is certain, and though sometimes the mills of God's judgment grind slowly, nevertheless, the judgment of evil is certain. And secondly, and don't miss this point, there is always an announcement of a specific deliverance of God's people in all fulfilled prophecies. And everyone that's fulfilled, God has delivered his people from those atrocities and those horrors. Lesson number three. God is sovereign over all of human history. In fact, the book of Daniel is like a treatise of God's sovereignty on steroids. The prophecies of Daniel don't just assert that God has some sort of uncanny knowledge about the future. No, he knows because he controls. I know that's a harsh truth. But when Nebuchadnezzar has his sanity restored by God in Daniel chapter 4, he says, all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. God does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stop his hand or say to him, what have you done? Now I know God's sovereignty presents its own problems. It can be viewed as a philosophical problem, like, well, how can free will be in any sense free if God is really sovereign? But that is not how Daniel approaches it. It's not a philosophical issue to Daniel. From Daniel's point of view, there's no conundrum about it. But Daniel is proclaiming the good news to a captive people that the eradication of evil and their deliverance is going to happen because God is sovereign. I mean, I know in the classroom and in Bible studies, the whole issue of free will and sovereignty, it can be a huge problem. But in the real world, the sovereignty of God has never once been a problem. You know what the problem has been? It's when men declare themselves sovereign and they drift away from accountability and not the knowledge of God. And they, as they drift farther from God, they try to set up their own heavens on earth. And every time they do, ladies and gentlemen, whether it's the Third Reich or a communist era or something that's yet to happen in the future, every time some utopian state is set up, it's supposed to be heaven on earth, but it becomes hell on earth for somebody. And millions of people just in the last century were exterminated because somebody had a utopian vision and certain classifications of people don't fit in. And it's when men become autonomous and when men become sovereign, that's the thing that in history worries me. Men that believe they will not give an account to God. The sovereignty of God is really no problem. Not really in history, not really in practice. It is the sovereignty of God that tells me that even though it looks like the world is going to hell in a handbasket sometimes, that in reality, God is sovereign, and the guarantee that his word will come to pass and Christ will return and he will set up that fifth and final kingdom is sure to come to pass as I'm here thumping my index finger on the podium. The sovereignty of God is what guarantees this. It's not a philosophical conundrum to Daniel. I know it is to us, but not to Daniel. If you understand how Daniel views this, it is the guarantee that God will deliver his people. And lesson number four, it is this uncanny accuracy of fulfilled prophecy that should fortify your belief in unfulfilled prophecy, prophecy that's yet to come. The Bible proclaims a day when God will call all flesh to give an account before the judgment seat of Christ. Do you think that Mao Zedong believed that? I don't think so. Though at the very end of his life, he did tell Richard Nixon, I have an appointment with God. He knows he's dying, and he says to Richard Nixon, you know, I have an appointment with God. The Bible proclaims that God will call all flesh to give an account, not before him in some sort of general sense, but it actually says all men will give an account before his Son, Jesus Christ. Now, that's just a prediction, right? Doesn't it have like maybe a 50-50 chance, a 60-40 chance? No, because it stands on the shoulders of reams and reams of fulfilled prophecy. That's the point of studying fulfilled prophecy. The Bible indicates that a prophetic vision of the future can actually shape Littleton Bible Chapel into being a more moral, a more wary, a more guarded, a more wise, and even a more loving people. Proverbs 29:18 says, where there is no prophetic vision, the people cast off restraint. But blessed is he who keeps the law. You get that? No prophetic vision, cast off restraint. If I had no belief that I will one day give an account, of course I would cast off restraint. But I believe, I'm a man that I know I will one day give an account, as will you and you and you. Every one of us will. We'll have our day before the judge of the universe. And Peter asks in 2 Peter 3:11, what sort of people ought you to be in lives of holiness and godliness, waiting for the hastening of the coming of the day of God? You see? When you're waiting and you're anticipating the things that are to come, it should lead to holiness, actually. You know, I've told a story about elevated attentiveness. I think that's what fulfilled prophecy should lead to, is elevated attentiveness about life and living. I've told this story usually in a business context, and I think I've even told this story once here many years ago. So if you remember this story, you'll just have to forgive me. In the normal context of telling this story, it's in a business context where we are training people that are new in our company, and they are away from the everyday work-a-day world, and they have come to another city for training, and some of them think it's a party. That's not very conducive to training. So I tell them this story about World War II. Let me wet my whistle. This is a made-up story, but the context is real, as you will recognize. There was a sergeant who landed on D-Day when the Allies invaded France, Normandy. And they get off those transports, and they rush onto the beach, and luckily they're not in the first wave where the mortality rates are like 90%. And they make it up the cliffs, and they fight the enemy, and finally all the Germans that were guarding those bluffs, they surrender. And so this particular sergeant loses two men, and he's given two, and his men are given 2 days of R&R. And they give him reinforcements to replace two men. And in those days, sergeants had to write the letters to the parents of the boys that died in battle. And after he'd penned those two letters and given them to the military post, he said, I don't want to write any of those letters again. And so he gets his orders, and he's supposed to attack a French village not too far from where they're having their R&R the very next morning. With the orders comes a small map that's actually printed on a piece of like grocery paper, like the wrappings around meat. It's just scrap paper. It's all wrinkled. But it's a handmade map that was secreted out of the village from the French resistance. And it's got all the streets in the village. It's not a very big village. But key to the map, it shows where the Nazis are and where the pillboxes are and where the barbed wire and where the landmines are and where the streets are that aren't protected. What would be the best way to enter and take the village? So he begins to drill his soldiers on the details of that map. He shows them the map. He asks them to memorize the map. He gives them a test about the map. And the soldiers all get it 100% right. Now fast forward 45 years. And this sergeant is now an old man. And he's on a tour bus with all sorts of American veterans and their wives. And they just got done visiting Normandy. And some of those men, because they had never been back to France in all of their lives, they just broke down in tears when they saw where they were wounded or their comrades had died. And as they got back on the bus to go to the hotel, the tour guide gets the microphone in the bus and he says, now tomorrow we're going to go to this village and we're going to go to this village and we're going to go to this village. One of those villages is the village that the now old sergeant took with the help of that map. And so he asks if he can have the microphone. And he gets up as the bus is driving back to the hotel and he tells him the story about the village and the map and teaching his soldiers and what happened. In fact, he even takes the whiteboard from the tour guide and he draws a picture of the map. And then it occurs to him, I'm gonna give the same test to the tourists that I gave to my soldiers. And the tourists got an only
50% right. Now, why did the soldiers get it 100% right? And why did the tourists only get 50% right? Because for the soldiers, it was a matter of what? Life and death. It was a matter of destiny. That's right. That's exactly right. Tourists never pay attention like soldiers do. Christian, are you bored? Are you drifting? You shouldn't be after this whole summer on the book of Daniel. Fulfilled prophecy has to do with your destiny and making your destiny more clear. Because all unfulfilled prophecy is anchored in fulfilled prophecy. It means the Bible's world eschatology and really your personal eschatology is all the more certain. And really, that's supposed to be a very sobering thought. But it's also supposed to be a happy thought, an enriching thought, a purifying thought. So I'm asking you, don't be a tourist. Be a soldier. Use the book of Daniel to give you more watchfulness about your life, to have more restraint in your life, that the fruits of God's Spirit would actually be born afresh, self-restraint and joy and peace and love. Maybe we'll actually have the rebirth of a true religion like James talked about in Littleton Bible Chapel, where we don't have enough religion to make us hate. That, the world is full of that kind of religion, but we have enough religion to make us love. Now, we are a loving group at Littleton Bible Chapel, but there is no end to love. Let's just close in a word of prayer. God, I just pray that you give us light through this passage and the whole book of Daniel. Help us to see that the government can be a restraint of evil, but it also can be a propagator of evil. So help us to always look at government, even our own, very watchfully and very carefully, and never take good government for granted. And then there are these testimonies through the scripture of fulfilled prophecy and how unfulfilled prophecy makes our destiny even more certain. And so let it shape us. Let it mold us. It is the mold that should mold our whole outlook about how we look at what we do tomorrow and the next month and the month after that. We have only limited days to do your will on this earth. And of course, greater responsibilities and opportunities may arise in the future, but they will be always of a different character.